the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A happy new week. A happy new day. And the question, we're going to have an interesting program today. Institute for Self-Reliance, David Morris, is going to drop by in our second hour. We're going to be talking about new city-states. What can America learn from Alaska's drug and privacy rules? Something most people in the lower 48 don't know anything about. It's really, really pretty fascinating. All the way back to 1978, if my recollection is correct, Alaska has said that your right to have pot in your home is protected by the privacy provision of the state constitution. But your right to have liquor is not. And we'll get into that, why that is. And then in our third hour, fracking activist Shane Davis is going to drop by. In this first hour, I'd like to raise a question. I'm making an assertion. But, maybe you've got other examples you can add to the mix. And on the one hand, I'm not super enthusiastic about turning this into a complaint fest. Maybe you have solutions. To the loss of democracy in America. I mean, this is what I want to cover in this first hour is, is America a democratic republic or a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic, which is what the founders set up? Is it that anymore? Or have we become an oligarchic aristocracy, a hereditary aristocracy? Great wealth moves down through families now rather than through merit and through effort. The people who occasionally rise up and make a whole pile of money, the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world, are few and far between. And Mark Zuckerberg now is funding in that secret window between October 15th and the November election. It turns out, he was one of the guys that was funding some right way. Well, I'll get into that in a second. But the point is that this whole idea of democracy in the United States, of a country of, by, and for the people, to paraphrase Abraham Lincoln, is on the edge of going away. In the one realm, you've got the kind of Ed Snowden revelations of the infrastructure for a police state having been aggressively constructed after 9/11 by the Bush administration and still in place and still growing. So there's that. But more importantly is the power of billionaires and corporations to control legislation. There is so much money in this town right now. Because the best investment you can make in the United States for many businesses, not all, but for many businesses, is to buy politicians. Or even better is to buy legislation. You can buy legislation at the state level by joining ALEC and getting your legislation in there. You can buy legislation at the federal level by hiring a lobbying firm. And people are doing this. For example, the banksters. Here, this is a headline from a column by Zach Carter in the Huffington Post. The headline pretty much says it all. Wall Street demands derivatives deregulation and government shutdown bill. Okay. Well, that sounds pretty bad. Wall Street's demanding derivatives deregulation. It's even worse. Under Dodd-Frank, if a bank wants to gamble on derivatives, and they are doing it, right? It's back to being a $400-600 trillion, nobody knows, market. And under Dodd-Frank, if a bank wants to do that, they have to do it out of a division of the bank, a corporation of that the bank owns, which is not FDIC insured. Meaning that if their derivative bets go down the tubes, as happened in 2007, they cannot turn to the federal government and say, make us whole, or they here's the system, here's how it would work. Let's say that you're banking with Bank of America, and just to pull a name out of the air. And I don't know if the Bank of America is doing this or not. So maybe we should call it Acme Bank, actually. Let's say you're banking with Acme Bank, and Acme Bank has a gambling division, right, an investment division, an investment advisor. It's called Acme Bank Investment Advisors or something like that, where you can buy stock and they'll manage your 401k and, you know, that kind of stuff. And they've got a commercial banking division where you can have a checkbook and a savings account and a credit card. Now, the commercial division is, you know, where your money is deposited. That's protected by the FDIC. So if you have up to $250,000 in the bank and that bank goes down in flames, up to $250,000, you get repaid by the government, by FDIC, which is, by the way, underfunded. So what Dodd-Frank said was, if you're going to do derivative trades that could cause your bank to lose so much money that you would have to take your investors' funds, you can't do that out of an FDIC-insured bank. In other words, you can't, because the way it would work is, you know, hey, I'm sitting here, I'm a customer of Bank of America, Wells Fargo, whatever, and I've got, you know, $5,000, $10,000, whatever it may be in my checking and savings account with that bank, $50,000, $100,000, you name it, anything less than $250,000. The bank has huge derivatives losses, and so they simply say, we're taking your money to pay off our losses, and the federal government will repay you. This is what the banks want. It's not what they have right now. Under Dodd-Frank, they don't have this. But here, according to this story, Wall Street lobbyists are trying to secure taxpayer backing for many derivative trades. The banks are pushing hard. These would allow financial institutions to trade certain financial derivatives from subsidiaries that are insured by the FDIC. And Congress looks like, you know, the Republicans are you know, just gung-ho for this. This is, once again, another demonstration. Mitch McConnell's in favor of this. Another demonstration, apparently, of how, and in fact, this is being, well, oddly enough, this is being pushed by a Democrat, Congressman Jim Himes of Connecticut. He introduced a bill to this effect last year. The bill was written by a Citigroup lobbyist. So it's both parties. Here's another one. The government shutdown talks may gut retirement security rule. This is amazing. This is amazing. Just consider this for a moment. When you hire a financial advisor, you go into Edward Jones and Company or Fidelity, or I mean, you know, fill in the blank, right? You go to some company that does investment advice and say, I've got a 401k or I'm going to start one, and here's my $10,000 to start it this year. You invest the money. There is a rule that is not in place, but has been proposed by Democrats in the House of Representatives that would require investment advisors to act in the best interest of their clients. Right now, what they can do is say, okay, cool, I'm going to put you into this fund, the Acme Widget Fund, which, by the way, pays me a 20% commission. Right? So they take your money and they act in their best interest, not your best interests. And because, you know, I mean, 401k fees over the course of a lifetime can add up to well over $100,000 for the average American who has a 401k, which is, you know, probably the top 20% of Americans. But whatever, it's an enormous amount of money, maybe the top 50%. I don't know. But this policy would impose a fiduciary duty on financial professionals who oversee retirement accounts, barring them from considering the potential profits of their own firm when choosing investments. Instead, they have to pick stocks, bonds, and other assets based on what's best for the retiree. This was first introduced by the Department of Labor, the Obama administration, in 2010, and it was tabled after massive pushback from the finance industry. Now, Republicans are pushing a budget rider. Right. I got more on the list here. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So I'm going to go through this. The next one is why rich people marry, and what does that have to do with this? And then I'm going to throw the lines open for your thoughts and comments on what's happening to democracy in America. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jared watching Free Speech TV in Burlington, Vermont on the cable system there. Hey, Jared, what's on your mind today?
Tom, hi. I'd like to turn back to last week when you were talking about Ferguson and Staten Island.
Mm-hmm.
I was a fire commissioner here in Burlington. certainly not the what happens in Burlington doesn't apply to all the United States. But what I do think maybe does apply is that there was pointed out by one of our captains in the fire department that the headset is very different between fire and police. And you sort of lump them together, particularly in Staten Island. What he pointed out to me, and it may or may not apply to the larger discussion, what he pointed out was everyone is glad to see a fireman, and not everyone is glad to see a policeman.
Correct.
They're both a military outfit. They're similar in many ways.
Well, hang on just a second. Firemen don't carry weapons. How can they be considered military? I mean, they're both government employees, and they're both part of government bureaucracies that serve the people, but I don't see where the military aspect of the fire department comes.
Well,
you mean they wear uniforms and they have, you know, ceremonial parades and things?
Correct. And they both have the same sort of rising to the ranks. There are a lot of similarities, and there's a strong dissimilarity in the sense that they're very different people.
Right.
The policemen are somewhat closed, and the firemen are very open. They come from the same place, but they're different, and both have a lot of heavily weighted to military veterans. Mm-hmm. But they're. What I wanted to point out, and what I think you were saying, was the fact that there are a lot of retired police and a lot of retired firemen living in Staten Island. They're not the same.
Mm-hmm. So you think the firemen are more liberal, for lack of a better word?
Liberal is the wrong word. Yeah. I see what you're saying. They're more fair. They're more open.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that liberal is the correct word.
Yeah.
They probably would both vote Republican.
Yeah, no, I understand.
But they're not the same people, and that's what I think when the discussion that was going on last week was that, particularly with Staten Island, that fire and police were being, you know, retired fire, retired police were putting in the same bag, and
Correction noted, Jared. I'm curious. Did you see the video of when it wasn't even fire department, it was the medics, you know, the ambulance showed up to pick up Eric Garner, and they didn't even bother to try to resuscitate him. Did you see that video?
I did not.
Okay. Because, you know, the police, it was 7 minutes from the time they took him down and killed him, basically. And he was not breathing for 7 minutes when the fire department got there. And I think that's probably too long to revive somebody. But I was just, you know, there are some people who are saying, hey, wait a minute, those guys should have tried. But I just don't know. Jared, thank you for the call, and thanks for the correction. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Okay, so I'm just going through. These are just some stories that I saw in the media over the weekend, and I emailed them to myself, and I just came in this morning and printed them all out. And, you know, that Wall Street is trying to rewrite the laws, the banking regulation laws, so that you and I, through the FDIC, so that we the people will guarantee we will backstop their trading in derivatives, right, their risky gambling, which is mind-bogglingly profitable for them. It's why these guys are taking multi-million-dollar bonuses here at the end of the year. Secondly, the investment advisor, Wall Street again, investment advisors, they're horrified by the idea that they may have to act in your interest rather than their own. This is a piece that was over in the Huffington Post, written by Zach Carter and Dave Jamieson. And they say Republicans are pushing a budget rider that would require the Labor Department to mediate its rule with the more corporate-friendly Securities Exchange Commission, which financial reform experts said they believe would render the proposal toothless. The Republican-led House has vowed to block the Labor Department from moving forward with the rule in the past. Backers of the Workers are increasingly relying on 401k plans. Backers of the rule say it would give workers some basic protection by discouraging 401k brokers from pushing plans based on the fees going to those brokers' firms. Banks are also pressing Congress to curb one reform to the derivatives market that was passed under Dodd-Frank. That bill had banned banks from trading some derivatives from subsidiaries that receive taxpayer insurance. So two different things. One, the banks want you and I to protect them. Two, they want to do away with any protection for you and me with regard to a 401k or any kind of retirement funds. Then there's an article. This was in the Sunday Times, yesterday's paper, Andrew Sherlin, The Real Reason Richer People Marry. And they're pointing out that as of last year, among 20 to 49-year-old men, more than half, 56%, of those who are professional, managerial, or technical workers were married. Whereas among service workers, which would be from, you know, the people who clean apartment buildings and hotels to waiters and waitresses I'm guessing service people includes things like burgers and working at McDonald's, maybe at Walmart. Among service workers, only 31% of men in the age range of 20 to 49 are married. 56% for professional, managerial, and technical, 31% for service workers. This is a huge, what's called a marriage gap. And it's only happened twice in the last 150 years or 130 years. They went back and looked over the last 130 years and found that there were two times. They said the current era is, this is Andrew Sherlin, he says the current era is not the first time the nation has experienced a large marriage gap. It is at least the second. Another instance occurred in the late 19th century. What these two eras have in common is that high economic inequality was high and rising during both of them. The first marriage gap occurred between 1880 and 1910. An area during a period that Mark Twain labeled the Gilded Age, writes Andrew Sherlin. And then he goes on to say, what the census data demonstrate is a strong association between the level of economic inequality and the level of marriage inequality. When inequality was low and stable during the prosperous post-World War II years, marriage rates were more similar, and proportions of married people reached historic high points for all groups. He also points out that There's a conservative argument, a Rush Limbaugh argument that's being made for why only a third of service workers are married, whereas more than half of professional workers are married. And the conservative argument is, oh, they're lazy. Those guys who just work at Walmart or whatever, they're just lazy. And they're not committed, so they're not getting married. Well, it turns out, no, they're not making enough money. That's what's going on. They feel like they can't afford to get married. Now, here's another one. This is from the New York Times over the weekend. Eric Lipton wrote this. It was published yesterday. The headline, Energy Firms in Secretive Alliance with Attorneys General. Now, a few months ago, the Times had reported about how there was this new group of attorneys general who were aggressively, for the first time ever, taking money from corporations and billionaires. Turns out it's Republican attorneys general. Attorneys general at least a dozen states are working with energy companies and other corporate interests, which in turn are providing them with record amounts of money for their political campaigns. They start out the story with the Oklahoma AG. Now, keep in mind, the attorney general is supposed to be the chief law enforcement officer in the state. Bribery is a crime. So you would think that if the chief law enforcement officer is being bribed, he should put himself in jail, but apparently not so much. Eric Lipton starts the article out. The letter to the EPA from Attorney General Scott Pruitt of Oklahoma carried a blunt accusation. Federal regulators were grossly overestimating the amount of air pollution caused by energy companies drilling new natural gas well sites in Oklahoma. But Mr. Pruitt, the Attorney General, left out one critical point in his letter to the head of the EPA. The three-page letter was written by lawyers for Devon Energy, one of Oklahoma's biggest oil and gas companies, and was delivered to him by Devon's chief of lobbying. So the attorney general for the state is now acting as an agent for a corporation against the federal government. The email exchange from October 2011, obtained through an open records request, offers a hint of the unprecedented secretive alliance that Mr. Pruitt and other Republican attorneys general have formed with some of the nation's top energy producers to push back against the Obama regulatory agents agenda. I mean, this is Attorneys general have shut down investigations, changed policies, agreed to more corporate-friendly settlement terms after intervention by lobbyists and lawyers, many of whom are also big campaign benefactors. So this is what the Supreme Court has done. It has totally corrupted our country. Mr. Pruitt, with a lot of, has responded aggressively with a lot of helping hands. Energy industry lobbyists drafted letters for him to send to the EPA, the Interior Department, the Office of Management and Budget, and even to President Obama. The Attorney General of Oklahoma sends a letter to President Obama on official Attorney General of Oklahoma letterhead. The letter was written by a lawyer for an energy company, or a lobbyist for an energy company. Meanwhile, Tom Harkin wants to take money from Pell Grants and give it to the loan contractors. He's on the Education Committee in the Senate. He's retiring. What is his next job, working for a private education contractor or bank? What do you want to bet? I'm willing to put money on that one. And then finally, these super PACs, you'll remember I pointed out on October 15th, after that, super PACs could get filled up with money. Boy, did that happen. Back with your thoughts.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Back with your thoughts on this right after the break. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 28 minutes before the hour. Before the hour. There we go. And so The thing that is, like, right out in front of us, it's right out in front of us. It's being shoved in our face. First of all, I don't understand, given that, you know, Republicans are trying to do everything from, you know, gut programs for students to gut protections for retirees and investors. I don't get how anybody could ever vote for a Republican. But on the other hand, I just cited two Democrats who are involved in this stuff, too. We have to get money out of politics. As long as money is considered speech under the First Amendment, which is a doctrine that the Supreme Court first put forward in 1976 in a case called Buckley versus Vallejo, and then they amplified with Citizens United. As long as money is considered speech and corporations are considered persons. But number one, the money as speech is the most egregious part. Because what it does is it says, okay, you know, Shelley Adelson has a much bigger voice than anybody else. In fact, I started out talking about these funding groups. They had to file where all their money came from by October 15th. The elections were November 4th, so, you know, another 2.5 weeks. On November 15th, there were a whole bunch of groups that didn't even exist or had existed but were not funded. And then, you know, people come along and say, ho-ho, let me throw some cash in. Here, for example, this is from Paul Blumenthal over at the Huffington Post. The race to replace rehiring Congressman Henry Waxman in his L.A. County district saw very little spending from outside groups until the final weeks of the campaign, when two super PACs backing Republican candidate Ellen Carr began an advertising blitz. Now, here's the thing. This PAC spent over $500,000, $506,000. Trashing the Democrat. In fact, saying that the Democrat was a friend of Hamas because she had or he had gotten a donation, or excuse me, an award from CARE, the Council on Islamic American Islamic Relations, which is a very middle of the road milquetoast group. It turns out it was Shelley Adelson behind it, and we're finding out this week. We found out late last week, actually, because, you know, the filings, October 15th was the filing date. And after that, if the money went in, we didn't learn about it until after the election. This is a huge loophole that is being used. So anyway, my rant is, I think, fairly complete at this point. I'll turn it over to you, Kurt, in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Kurt.
Yeah, Tom, I wanted to reflect something you said about the retirement investments.
Yeah.
And we all know that the Democrats can't message to save their life, and Bernie Sanders is the only one that can. But I think this is where I'm in disagreement with the skill sets our president has for getting a message across. You always cite former presidents and their skills to to bang the bully pulpit. I don't understand why he doesn't simply say, when they, with the Republicans trying to divert that bill, interest of the investor, why he says this is how he should say something to the fact, this is how despicable Congress is. They're trying to undermine retired Americans.
And students.
And students.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, what is it going to take for him to say, listen, they don't like me no matter what. So if they try to use a angry black man card, you know, so bad.
Here's, you know, Kurt, it's not as simple as Obama isn't doing his job. First of all, Obama has been saying a lot of fairly strong comments recently, in particular over the last month or so. They just don't get echoed and amplified. There's no left-wing echo chamber the way that there's a right-wing echo chamber. If George W. Bush said something, it moved to the right-wing radio sphere. Literally every city in America, every person in America can listen to right-wing radio hosts. There are only a dozen or so major cities in the United States that carry progressive radio. So, and Sirius satellite, of course, all across the country. So it's like the mess, even so the beginning of the echo chamber is there. Then it moves to right-wing TV, which is Fox. There's no comparison to that. MSNBC is sort of left-wing television 3 hours a night. But, you know, it starts out with Joe Scarborough in the morning. It's right-wing television and right-wing messaging that's frankly, I think, more effective than Fox because it's more subtle. And you know, on the weekend, a couple of times, I turned on the TV, turned on MSNBC to see what's going on in the news. There's no news on MSNBC. It's a documentary, mostly about prison. And so there's no left-wing television, full-time television network the way that there is Fox. So you've got this giant infrastructure on the right that amplifies their messages. And by the way, all the things that I just went through, you won't hear a word of any of those on Fox News. And frankly, you won't hear them on any of these big networks because the networks themselves are doing this. I mean, they're trying to destroy, for example, organized labor. You've got big networks that are busting their unions right now. It's one of the reasons you don't hear a discussion about organized labor on television, by and large. And so it's, you know, yeah, I'm all in favor of the president getting better at his messaging. But the fact of the matter is that we don't have a media infrastructure that will echo that out well. And that's, you know, very simply the consequence of 1982 when Ronald Reagan said, I'm not going to enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act anymore. And then over time, the FCC kept changing their ownership requirement rules. And now you've got television stations, radio stations, newspapers all across the United States, basically the media of our country in the hands of a half a dozen corporations. And then on top of that, even on the internet, you've got, you know, six or eight major sites that pretty much are gatekeepers for everything. Kurt, thank you for the call. I mean, you identified a problem, but I don't think it's the problem. Chris in Ayer, Massachusetts. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to know why we don't invert the conversation, right? If money is speech and I'm entitled to free speech, then doesn't that make poverty unconstitutional?
And
isn't there an element, right, of freedom and liberty that our libertarian, you know, adversaries like to yell about that's required to participate in the private economy they worship like a god?
Yeah.
Right? They've decided to switch our democratic vote in for wealth.
Right.
Well, we have the right to vote because it's about participatory democracy. Well, if you're going to change our entire system to be about money, then that just inherently switches the value structure from what we demanded within the legislative process to the economic system.
Right. Which is what it's done. I mean, you know, basically Reaganomics, libertarian philosophy, conservative economic philosophy, neoliberalism, whatever you want to call this, that has been in place since 1981 and has been getting more and more and more extreme and more and more and more cancer-like in the 34 years since then, 33 years since then, has moved our political. It used to be that our political world and our economic world were separate. That was the whole point of Lewis Powell's memo to Eugene Sindor, his friend, neighbor, and the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in 1971. He said, you know, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has never gotten involved in politics, and it's time to get involved in politics. And, you know, then in 1976, Lewis Powell, by that time, Richard Nixon had put him on the Supreme Court, and he authored the Buckley case, which gave, you know, corporate free speech which gave the, you know, which said the speech was spending money was free speech under the First Amendment. And it's an interesting point that you make, though. If you've got free speech, why can't you have free money? Chris, thanks for the call. That was a very good one. Benjamin in Los Angeles, listening on KPFK. Hey, Benjamin.
Hey, Tom. I wanted to jump ahead to fracking. I know you want to talk about it in hour three, if that's okay.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
I worked in the oil field in North Dakota for a year,
mm-hmm.
and I saw what it did to decimate the landscape, the environment, the animals up there. The problem is that I live in a district where I have a pretty strong climate science denier for representatives.
Mm.
And even with all this evidence that I've seen firsthand and evidence and you know, scientific research that says fracking is just the worst, what can we do to combat our representatives that just don't want to get involved in this really, really crucial issue?
Is your representative a Republican or a Democrat?
Dana Rohrabacher. He's a Republican.
Yeah. Well, I would say you want to work to unseat him. That would be the number one thing. And frankly, it is possible to unseat Republicans. You do it with economic populism. You don't get a Mary Landrieu kind of Democrat who's going to say, yeah, I'm a Democrat, except I agree with all these Republican positions. You get a Democrat who says, you know, here's where I stand, you know, like Bernie Sanders does, and campaigns on economic populism. You find some Democrat, join your local Democratic Party, and help them find, you know, primary candidate who's a genuine progressive populist, who's going to talk about economic issues, who's going to talk about the minimum wage, who's going to talk about, you know, our trade policies, something that's taboo even in large chunks of the Democratic Party, although Sherrod Brown speaks out about it, Bernie Sanders speaks out about it, Jan Schakowsky, Raul Grijalva, Keith Ellison, Alan Grayson, a lot of good people in the Progressive Caucus will speak out on this. And those positions will, you know, I think Dana Rohrabacher could be taken down. I think any Republican, this is the thing about the South. Everybody's going, oh, Mary Landrieu, last Democrat in the South is gone. That's it. No, that's not it. It's, you know, we need to, you know, we need another Huey Long, you know, Huey Long. Benjamin, thank you for the call. Huey Long with his Every Man's a King speech. I mean, track down that speech and read it. It's mind boggling. I mean, he's basically saying, you know, why can't every, you know, this is a rich country. Why can't everybody in this country have a minimum standard of living? Well, we can. But they did away with Huey Long. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We need the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party to reassert itself in every district in this country. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. John in Cayucos, California. Hey, John, thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Sure, Tom. Thank you. Hey, almost everything you've said this morning and all the things recently that have taken place, from Garner in Staten Island to Michael Brown to the 12-year-old that was killed, the Walmart killing, this Mitch McConnell legislation, almost everything seems to point to me and voter suppression. I think the bigger picture, using your other show, we need to look at the bigger picture. It's not about the color of our skin anymore. I mean, that obviously it isn't totally true. There's obviously racists out there. There's plenty of them, too many of them. But this is about participation suppression. The Republicans, the banksters, all these people, they don't care what color your skin is. If you're going to find a way to make it harder for them to steal our money, then they don't like you. They don't care. And so it all falls under the bigger umbrella of participation suppression.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want you and I or anyone else that I know to be part of their little world. And they do everything they can through legislation, through cheating, through stealing, through banking laws, through lending laws, through everything, to keep us out of their world.
Yeah.
And not that I would want to be in their world, but, you know, we all deserve a fair shot to be in the middle class. And they could care less.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. And they're getting so blatant about it. You know, I mean, it's just astonishing. You know, Eric Cantor proudly going off to a $4 million a year job, you know, as a lobbyist slash whatever he actually can't, he can't lobby for 2 years, but whatever they call it that he's doing. You know, these just the purchase of these politicians, Shelley Adelson having people fly out to Vegas and kiss his ring. I mean, it's just, it's mind boggling. I'm with you, John. Thank you for the call. Very well said. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hey, Tom, help me understand, what was the reason why Jared in Burlington, Vermont, it was, I believe, brought up the idea of there being a difference between police and firemen?
I'm not sure. I think that last week I or some guest said something about cops and firemen conflating the two, and he wanted to clear the record on that. I have no specific recollection of it, though, and I am always, I believe, relatively careful to differentiate between the two, because I think they're two very, very different cultures.
Well, other than the fact that we don't carry weapons and our and we're keyed towards rescue and putting out fires, police, on the other hand, cause fires, if you will, both metaphorically and literally.
Yeah.
But here's my personal experience from serving in the volunteer fire department in my community from the early 80s to the late 80s. With the exception of myself and maybe one or two other people, out of a roster of 30 people, 12 of whom were the core responders, my being one of the core, on an average of 450 to 600 calls a year, I could tell you that the vast majority of people that are attracted to that service are conservative and Republican voting, and they are very ignorant of current events and take little interest in that.
Right.
As a matter of fact, there was one or two members that reminded me of that policeman in Staten Island who chokeholded the black man to death, wearing jersey and a shorts and wearing a cap backwards.
Interesting. So you're saying that, it's drawing the same kind of person. That's fascinating. Johnny, thanks for sharing that. We'll be back. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Richard, driving through Arizona. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey, good morning to you, Tom, or good day, as I should say, because I think it's noon where you are.
Yeah, it is.
I was listening to what you were saying about these Republican AGs around the country taking money from chemical companies and then representing them against the better interests of their own states.
Right.
You know, that just sounds so much like corruption. You know, I don't get why our AG, of the country, isn't filing charges against these guys.
Well, first of all, I don't know if the state AGs are violating federal anti-corruption laws. I'm quite sure that they're not. I'm guessing these guys vetted this very, very carefully. Secondly, you know, you've got this issue of the separation of states and, you know, states' rights, of separation between federal and state functions. And if they are operating in a way that's corrupt and that is not representing well the people of their state, or not representing the interests of their state, you would think it would be up to the voters of the state to get rid of them. Almost all of them are elected positions, however, so the same billionaires and big corporations who are bribing them, essentially, to write letters to the president and challenge, and, you know, have lawsuits against EPA policies or even Obamacare. This is one of the agendas of this Republican AG's group, is to go after Obamacare. You know, it's legal. And so there's arguably a loophole in both state and federal law that's allowing this. And I think it's a real problem when the top attorney, when the top law enforcement officer in a state has been corrupted to the point where who's going to arrest the guy who arrests people?
Well, yeah, but I mean, even though at the state level, the state AG is almost like untouchable from a state level, the FBI investigates politicians all the time.
Right, but it's not illegal to collaborate. Well, maybe it is in some, but I, you know, no, none of the things that I have read argue that there is any illegality to what these people are doing. Now, whether that's because the laws have been done away with, because there were some fairly strong anti-corruption laws put into place in the 70s after the, you know, following the Nixon revelations. And I know a lot of those have been repealed. A lot of them have been struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. I frankly think, you know, and we did a show on this 5-6 months ago when the New York Times first did this big expose about how these Republican attorneys general were getting together and seeking money from billionaires and corporate donors. That was the early story. Is, oh, look at this. These AG races are getting really expensive, and these attorney generals are out there going to the people that traditionally they would regulate or they would imprison or they would oversee, and they're getting large amounts of money from them. Is that a problem? Now we know here 6 months later, yeah, it's a problem. And in fact, here's the evidence of what they're doing with that money. And if you really think that the Republican legislature of, you know, Michigan or Wisconsin or fill in the blank, Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, Arkansas, if you really think that the Republican legislatures are going to fix this problem, then I got a bridge to sell you. I mean, this is the destruction of democracy in America, you know, piece by piece.
I agree with you that the states themselves, you know, especially when they're already Republican-held states, I absolutely agree. There's nothing that's going to happen at the state level.
Right.
That's why I was wondering, like, what the federal government's role would be.
I don't think the federal government does not have, to the best of my knowledge, does not have the power to police the states. They can, you know, in general. I mean, there are specific things, specific laws that a state official could violate that could bring the feds in. The civil rights laws come to mind, the commerce laws. But this kind of thing where an AG is just behaving in a way that has the appearance of impropriety and maybe even the substance of it, I don't think it's covered by federal law. And again, you know, the Republicans have taken the House and the Senate, so they're not going to regulate this either. But Richard, I share your outrage, and I share your wish that Eric Holder or somebody in the DOJ could go after these guys, because this is just wrong. Richard, thank you for the call. Harold in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Harold, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Just the first truth is that the liberty of a democracy is not safe if the people tolerate the growth of private power to a point where it becomes stronger than the democratic state itself. That, in essence, is fascism. FDR.
Yeah, FDR did use the F word. And talked about how, you know, the Republicans were promoting a fascist agenda. I used to have the clip of it around here someplace. I'm not sure that I do anymore. But, yeah.
Yeah, one of my German friends said that the only difference between you guys and America and us in Germany is that we're post-fascist and you guys are pre-fascist. Would you agree with that?
I would not disagree with it. I'm not sure I'd make it as my assertion. But we may be mid-fascist rather than pre-fascist right now.
Okay.
Yeah. Using FDR's definitions. There's another one, by the way. If you FDR's last vice president, I'm drawing a blank on his name, which is making me crazy. But his last vice president wrote an op-ed in the New York Times. Henry Wallace was his name. Henry Wallace. And if you can Google Henry Wallace's name and my name, you'll find articles that I've written about this that quote his article at length, because it's pretty hard to find. But the New York Times asked the sitting vice president, are there fascists in the United States? And if so, do we have to worry about them? This was during World War II. And he said in his New York Times op-ed, he said, yes, there are fascists in the United States, and yes, there are Nazis in the United States, but the fascists we have to worry about are not the ones who've sworn loyalty to Hitler. The fascists we have to worry about are the ones who are the captains of industry and finance in this country, who would use their positions of great economic power to twist the levers of government in ways that benefit them and harm the average working American. Now, I'm paraphrasing this wildly because it's been 6 or 8 years since I read and wrote about Henry Wallace's article in the New York Times. But it is, and maybe during the break here, I can just track it down and go off on it. But it was absolutely brilliant. I mean, you know, Henry Wallace is coming around and, you know, reflecting FDR's perspective. He wasn't actually FDR's last vice president. That was Harry Truman. He was the one just before Harry Truman. So, Harold, thanks so much for the call. Appreciate it. We will be back. We're going to get into the, you know, what can we learn from Alaska, oddly enough, about privacy and pot right after this?
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And David Morris, the co-founder of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, director of the Institute's Initiative on the Public Good, author of five books, including New City States, the website ilsr.org, is on the line with us. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Tom. I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us. So I thought this was fascinating. This article over at Alternate, the headline, I don't know if you wrote the headline or if they changed it, because they do that frequently. What the rest of America can learn from Alaska over drugs and privacy?
Yes, I appreciate it. They write the headlines. They're always better than I am when they write the headlines.
Me too. Same here. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, you know, I wrote the piece because, you know, one of the main themes in the United States right now is, when does individual liberty trump state regulation and vice versa? It's not quite a left-right debate, really, but it is one of the more important debates. And in Alaska, they've been having that discussion for almost 40 years, and it's related to the issue of drugs.
So how?
Well, in 1972, Alaska, and we should remember that Alaska only joined the Union in 1959, so it was a very new state. And in 1972, overwhelmingly, 86-14, in a ballot initiative, the citizens of Alaska amended the Constitution to insert a privacy clause. Now, there are about 10 states that have privacy clauses in their constitution, but Alaska's is the simplest, the shortest, and in some ways the strongest. It reads, the right of the people to privacy is recognized and shall not be infringed. The legislature shall implement this section. So that went into effect in 1972, and the same year, someone was arrested given essentially the equivalent of a traffic ticket for possessing marijuana. And he refused to sign the ticket, and it went to court. And in 1975, the Alaska Supreme Court decided that the right to privacy extended to the right to use marijuana in one's home. And so, therefore, one was allowed from 1975 on to possess marijuana and to use it for personal use. It was a major breakthrough, and no other state has ever defined or interpreted their privacy clause in the same way.
Yeah. And why not?
Well, that's a very good question. I think in some ways the other privacy clauses are not quite as strong. They say the right to privacy is a constitutional provision unless the legislature decides otherwise.
Well, in this case, the way that the state Supreme Court ruled was that, I mean, the rationale of their ruling was harm, right? That the state can interfere in your privacy if it does so to benefit, to prevent harm to the larger public, not necessarily to protect you from harming yourself, which is the old rationalization, but to prevent harm to others. And you know, they concluded the pot was so harmless that, you know, it fell under the privacy protection. On the other hand, when people came before them and said, okay, how about cocaine? I want to use cocaine in my own home. Am I protected? And they said, no, you can die from an overdose of cocaine. You can't die from marijuana. And so cocaine, and then it came to alcohol, right?
Yes.
Tell us about
it. Alcohol, and with alcohol, they said alcohol was more like cocaine than it was for marijuana. Now, Alaska in 1979 gave communities the right for what's called a local option, which means that even though alcohol is legal to consume and to sell in Alaska, communities can ban its import and its sale. And so someone was arrested for importing alcohol into a community, and it went to the Supreme Court, and he argued that he was protected under the privacy provision of the Constitution, and the court looked at all the evidence and decided that, in fact, alcohol is a major epidemic in Alaska, especially in rural areas, and decided that that his privacy rights were trumped in that case by the state right, in fact, duty to perfect its citizens.
Right.
And so you have these three decisions. I mean, marijuana, cocaine, and alcohol. And each one, the state very, I think, judiciously, very deliberatively, looked at the body of scientific evidence and data related to health harms for the community in general, and decided in the case of marijuana that clearly it was not harmful enough that the state had a compelling reason for overriding the privacy provision. In the case of cocaine and in the case of alcohol, in fact, they did have a compelling reason. Now, in November of this year, Alaska, by an overwhelming vote, legalized marijuana. So now Alaska is legalized for recreational use in all of Alaska, but many of the communities, and there are 50 of them, that have exercised their right to have a local option provision in their communities, and therefore they ban the import of the sale, and some of them the possession of alcohol, are now asking that the new law, which is now being written based on the election in November of in a couple of months ago, that they include a local option, and they probably will, and so communities will have the right in Alaska to say that the sale and the import of marijuana is illegal within their borders, and you probably won't be able to smoke it on the streets, but they do not have the right to ban its possession and use in the home because of the Supreme Court decision in 1975.
Yeah, now with regard to the alcohol thing, I think most people are probably surprised to discover that there are cities in Alaska that have banned alcohol within their cities, but these are, by and large, correct me if I'm wrong, by and large communities that are all or heavily weighted toward indigenous people who have a long history of struggling with alcohol abuse.
Yes, indeed, that's the case, although Barrow is the largest community that bans not only the import but also the possession of alcohol. But essentially, you're right that it has been an epidemic among the indigenous people in Alaska, and the death rate and so forth, the health rate. I mean, the data was enormously compelling, it seems to me, when the Supreme Court made its decision in the middle 1980s.
Right. And the odds are that while some of, there may be a somewhat similar problem with marijuana dependency or abuse, it's not going to, if somebody is unemployed, can't find work, and instead of sitting around drinking themselves into a stupor, they sit around and smoke themselves into a stupor, at least 5-10 years down the road, they're not going to have blown out their liver.
Well, that's true, and in fact, a number of the communities that have exercised their local option related to alcohol voted in the majority in favor of legalizing marijuana. So it's going to be an interesting debate, and I would imagine that within those communities, when that debate takes place, you'll see the same sort of, I hope, the same deliberative process. They're going to certainly rely a lot, I think, on the Supreme Court's evidence, their evidentiary, aspect of their decision in making their own decisions. And so you're going to have a debate in, it may be 50, it may be 25 communities in Alaska as to whether, once again, the safety aspects of marijuana are such that the community should override the right of people to use it.
Is there any indication that any of this might be going viral to the rest of the country? We have just a few seconds left, David.
No, it is not at this point. There are 10 other states that have privacy provisions. It isn't clear, and those privacy provisions have never been used to protect the use of marijuana. On the other hand, marijuana has been used in, is now legalized in several states and will be legalized in more states. But I think that that issue of privacy, and the relationship of individual liberty to state regulation is one that Alaska can inform.
Yeah, marvelous. David Morris, the co-founder of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, director of the Institute's Initiative on the Public Good, author of 5 books, including New City States, ILSR.org, the website. David, thanks for dropping by.
Thanks a lot, Tom, for having me.
Great talking. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I got to share with you, Vice President Henry, I dug it out, my old article about it. I wrote it in 2004. Henry Wallace talks about fascism and FDR for that. 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, Bob watching Free Speech TV in Rohnert Park, California. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my phone call. I really appreciate it. I love your work.
Thank you.
I've been a voter for 50 years. I remember when Reagan was in California as governor. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, we had homeless on the streets.
Yeah,
he emptied all of the institutions,
the mental hospitals.
And then when he took down, you know, he took down the air traffic controllers. Couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
Anyway, I wanted to talk about, I'm going to donate to Free Speech TV because you guys can't go off the air.
Thank you.
And if I can do it, I have an income of $881 a month from my Social Security. And I'm helped a little bit by my daughter who affords me this phone, the phone you on. But, other than that, I'm going to donate another $60 now because I need to see you on the air.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And we'll send a bag of coal to the Koch brothers in your behalf too, Bob.
Great.
Thank you very much. Okay. I appreciate your call and your support and your watching Free Speech TV. Bob, you're an important part of this network. Thank you so much.
Keep up the good work, Tom.
I'll do my best. I'll do my very best. Thank you, Bob. Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky.
Hello, Tom.
Hey.
Yeah, I'm getting tired of being called a low-information voter.
Who called you that?
Well, the Republicans say the low-information voters.
Uh-huh. Oh, you went, and they're referring to Democrats?
Well, that's basically what they're referring to, but my point is the reason why there's low information is because the airwaves are pounded with right-wing perspectives.
I agree.
You got 3 hours of radio from, you got, no, about 7 hours, from noon until 7, 8 at night. You got right-wing Republicans. And the TV, it's Fox News, is 24/7 right-wing TV. And we work 1 and 2 jobs.
Right.
You know, people are working. I'm retired now, but when I was working, I didn't hear half of the stuff that I hear now.
Yeah.
And I'm much more informed now because I got an opportunity to sit down and listen and do my own self-thinking, look at my own situation and what they're proposing and how it applies to me.
Right.
And it's no good how it applies to me. Like you were talking about Ronald Reagan in the 81. Well, I don't see many graphs that show the decline of the unions and the decline in middle-class incomes.
Oh, there's this CEPR, the Center for Economic and Policy Research, Dean Baker's group, did a great report on that a year or two ago. There's a graphic that goes with it that I've used on The Big Picture on our TV show a few times. And as unionization goes down, wages go down. I mean, it's a little parallel line over the last 35 years. As the rate of unionization has collapsed to about a third of what it was, so have individual wages. Corky, thanks for the call. I'll have to dig that out one of these times. We'll have to use that again. We'll be right back. past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you and your media support group for We the People. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in his, there's a long title to this, it's the message from the president to the United States transmitting recommendations relative to the strengthening and enforcement of antitrust laws. FDR being the exact opposite of Ronald Reagan, right? Ronald Reagan ended the enforcement of our antitrust laws. Here is the quote from the speech in which FDR announced that he was going to be more aggressively enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and its subsequent antitrust laws. Quote, "The first truth is that the liberty of a democracy is not safe if the people tolerate the growth of private power to a point where it becomes stronger than the democratic state itself. That, in essence, is fascism, ownership of government by an individual, by a group, or by any other controlling power." End of quote. And we've got the audio of this kicking around here someplace, and when we track it down, I will play it for you. Then here, this is the other, I was telling you about Henry Wallace, who was FDR's vice president, probably around that time. Henry Wallace was a famous lefty. I mean, you know, he was, in fact, FDR replaced him with Harry Truman because Wallace was starting to draw serious fire from the right. He was such a lefty. But the New York Times, back in early 1944, the New York Times asked Vice President Henry Wallace, quote, "Would you please write a piece answering the following questions? What is a fascist? How many fascists have we? How dangerous are they?" Okay. And here are his answers. Here's what he wrote. This was April 9, 1944, New York Times. This is the height of the war against Germany and Japan. And they're asking him, what is a fascist? How many fascists do we have in the United States? How dangerous are they? Quote, Vice President of the United States, while we're at war with Hitler, quote, "The really dangerous American fascists are not those who are hooked up directly or indirectly with the Axis, with Germany and Japan. The FBI has its finger on those. The dangerous American fascist is the man who wants to do in the United States in an American way what Hitler did in Germany in a Prussian way. The American fascist would prefer not to use violence. His method is to poison the channels of public information. With a fascist, the problem is never best how to present the truth to the public, but how best to use the news to deceive the public into giving the fascist and his group more money or more power." Can you imagine if Joe Biden came out and said this right now? He says, "If we define an American fascist as one who, in case of conflict," this is again Henry Wallace, Vice President of the United States, New York Times, June of 1944. "If we define an American fascist as one who, in case of conflict, puts money and power ahead of human beings, there are undoubtedly several million fascists in the United States. There are probably several hundred thousand if we narrow the definition to include only those who, in their search for money and power, are ruthless and deceitful. They are patriotic in times of war because it is in their interest to be so. But in time of peace, they follow power and the dollar wherever they may lead." Think of Dick Cheney. He said, "Fascism is a worldwide disease. The greatest threat to the United States will come after the war and will manifest within the United States itself." He continued, "Still another danger is represented by those who, paying lip service to democracy and the common welfare, in their insatiable greed for money and power which money gives," who comes to mind when you talk about this, "do not hesitate surreptitiously to evade the laws designed to safeguard the public from monopolistic extortion. American fascists of this stamp were clandestinely aligned with their German counterparts before the war and are even now preparing to resume where they left off after the current unpleasantness ceases." He said, "Some in big business are willing to jeopardize the structure of American liberty to gain some temporary advantage. monopolists who fear competition and who distrust democracy because it stands for equal opportunity would like to secure their position against small and energetic businesses. In an effort to eliminate the possibility of any rival growing up, some monopolists would sacrifice democracy itself. He goes on to say that the symptoms of fascist thinking are colored by environment and adapted to immediate circumstances, but always and everywhere they can be identified by their appeal to prejudice and by the desire to play upon the fears and vanities of different groups in order to gain power. It is no coincidence that the growth of modern tyrants has in every case been heralded by the growth of prejudice. It may be shocking to some people in this country to realize that without meaning so, they hold views in common with Hitler when they preach discrimination. The American fascists are most easily recognized by their deliberate perversion of truth and fact, Henry Wallace wrote. Their newspapers and propaganda carefully cultivate every fissure of disunity, every crack in the common front against them. They claim to be super patriots, but they would destroy every liberty guaranteed by the Constitution. They demand free enterprise, but they are the spokesman for monopoly and vested interest. Their final objective, toward which all their deceit is directed, is to capture political power, so that using the power of the state and the power of the market simultaneously, they may keep the common man in eternal subjection. This is the definition of fascism written in the New York Times in June of 1944 by the sitting Vice President of the United States, Henry Wallace. Tell me it doesn't apply today. And who are the fascists if this is the definition?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
I mean, this is how far we've come in America, that this was the public discourse in 1944, and today we're not even, there's no conversation about any of this in the corporate media. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Will in Blakesley, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will, how you doing?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Good.
You opened your show about, you know, do we still have a democracy? And no, we don't. I'm sorry. That's going to be, I mean, in my opinion, that's a pretty easy one to answer. But the big issue, and you've mentioned it, it's so obvious, is the blackout of the media we have by real news. I wouldn't even say liberal news because it's worse than that. I mean, they don't cover anything that's liberal. That's true. But it's anything that's real, it just completely blacked out. And all I can say is I can't think of anything better than. And I've been doing this for years. I do it, like, feverishly. I use guerrilla tactics. Now, I'm not talking violence or anything like that. I mean guerrilla tactics in the sense that what I do often, almost every day, actually, is I post real news on sites that won't do that, including newspaper sites, the, of course, Republican sites. I just post it and just so they, at least a handful of people will be forced to see something they'll never see, and I just walk away and move on. And it does get a charge out of people, obviously, but other than that, I don't know what we can do. I mean, it's pretty grim. It's pretty scary, I got to tell you. But
yeah.
That's, you know, I post your site all the time, by the way. I mean, I can't think of a better news site. I really mean it. I mean, there's lots of others, of course, you know, the ones that you mentioned, Amy Goodman, and there are many, many others. But I other than using simple, like, single citizen public action guerrilla tactics, I don't know how you break through the market.
Well, that's happening, and technology. We've got, you know, there's this very in phrase right now, disruptive technology. Uber is calling themselves a disruptive technology. They're disrupting the model of the taxi business, for example. And I would say that, you know, Twitter in particular, but Twitter, Facebook, and some of the other social media sites, but those two being the big ones, are disruptive media themselves, and what they are disrupting is the ability of politicians to get away with stuff. Although, you know, they're still pretty damn successful at it. But yeah, I think so. And good on you for being part of that change, Will. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for what you're doing. Joel, driving through Kansas. Hey, Joel, what's up?
Well, my question to you is, what if we're going to talk about money and politics? And we're going to talk about corporations. Are we not going to talk about SEIU, George Soros, Warren Buffett, those individuals as well, and numerous other billionaires on the left that also contribute?
Sure. Why not?
Why not? I mean, are we going to restrict that money flow as well?
Yes, of course.
Okay. Well, and that's fine. I mean, that's fine. I just want to, I mean, you didn't mention those individuals.
Well, I didn't mention any specific right wingers either. I'm talking about money in politics. It's wrong. And you know, in 1947, Taft-Hartley specifically forbade unions from participating in political activity unless they're a majority of their members supported it. But I would go a step further. I would say that unions, just like any other organization, whether it's a church, a 501c3, whether it's Karl Rove's PAC, or whether it's Tom Steyer's PAC, that none of them should be able to. That the money is not speech. Money, spending money for politics is behavior, and behavior can be regulated. And that behavior, it should be an absolutely equal level playing field. If a union wants to participate in politics, or the Koch brothers want to participate in politics, the rules should be the same. And those rules after 1973 were pretty stringent. There were, you know, there were only particular, very specific ways that you could insert money into a political campaign, and it had to be highly transparent. And that has been devastated by the U.S. Supreme Court. And frankly, I believe, Joel, that if these rules were put into place, that it would actually benefit the unions. Now, I know that there are people in the union movement who strongly disagree with me on this. And in fact, there were a couple of Democratic senators and members of the House of Representatives who recently introduced an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that would say that the right to spend money on politics is not a free speech right, at least for for-profit corporations. And my response to them, and in one case, I actually, you know, met with the legislative director of one of these senators and said, I think you're wrong. I don't think that you should limit this to for-profit corporations. And, you know, one of the most politically active non-for-profit corporations, the two largest, one handling over $300 million, the other handling, you know, over $500 million, are run by Karl Rove and David Koch and Charles Koch. But, you know, so you want to exempt nonprofits, you'll just see all the corruption move over to the nonprofit side. And, oh, and the other big player are in aggregate, the unions are probably spending money that's at a level similar to that. But where, in my opinion, this would work to the benefit of a union is that if you level that playing field and said, that's it, no more institutional involvement in politics. Institutions, whether they're unions, whether they're churches, whether they are corporations, do not have a First Amendment right to involve themselves in politics. If we were to go back before the 1977 Boston versus Bilotti decision that basically said, A, money is speech, and B, corporations can participate in that. And this was heavily pushed by Lewis Powell, by the way. If we went back to that, then frankly, I think that works to the benefit of unions because unions are democracies. Corporations are not democracies. Corporations are kingdoms. So if the CEO of a corporation, you know, say the CEO of AT&T pushes out an email to all, you know, 70,000 employees they have or however many they have in the United States saying, you know, you really should vote for Mitt Romney this time around. You know, people will look at that and go, yeah, maybe yes, maybe no, I don't care. You know, it's yeah, I'm not going to do it just because he said so. On the other hand, if a union says to its membership, who should we as a union endorse, and more than 51% of the members say, oh, you should endorse Mitt Romney, then that union is, you know, there's shoe leather there. They can say, you know, okay, go out and call people, you know, do things that don't involve cash. And because it's a democracy, it's a membership organization. Any membership organization can enlist its members. But I don't think Grover Norquist, with his, you know, his $15 million lobbyist here on K Street in Washington, D.C., I don't think that he's going to enlist an army of people who, you know, shoe leather, who are going to show up at the doors of members of Congress the way that people who are interested in their own survival in the workplace can and do. Am I making sense, Joel?
Well, yeah, and you just brought up another point that's very evident right now is money in lobbying and laws, because, you know, this whole Keystone Pipeline issue. I do know that you know, Warren Buffett does own our part ownership in the railway that brings oil right now down from Canada, where he's been the biggest voice behind the scenes against the Keystone, because if that occurs, then he's out multi-millions, billions of dollars, because Now it's not shipping down here via rail; it's coming down via the pipeline.
Yeah, well, so, it's not in large quantities. It's not being shipped down by rail anyway. But I think you're wildly overestimating the size of CSX's position within Buffett's portfolio, and then you're wildly overestimating the consequences of their carrying a lot of oil or not carrying a lot of oil. Right now, they're actually arguably losing money for Warren Buffett on carrying that oil because they're using these old 111 cars that blow up. And every time one blows up, it wipes out the profitability for the previous quarter. And it's happening more and more frequently. So it's really problematic for them. And I have never heard Warren Buffett make any statement at all about Keystone XL. So, you know, again, but if, you know, you can take it from a conservative perspective, I can take it from a liberal perspective. I think that what we both can agree on, I hope, Joel, is that our politicians should be representing the voters, we the people. They should be doing what we want, whatever that is, not what their rich donors want.
And that is absolutely one point we can totally agree on, is that money in either in the political process or in the legislative process, as long as it's there, it does hinder. But like me,
it corrupts.
I'm on the road from Iowa to spend 4 months down in Tucson, Arizona, for my job, being away from my family, because that's the job I can get right now that pays well enough for, and it does take away from our voice when the money in either the legislative or the political sector is influenced.
Yeah.
By that, and that is one thing we can definitely agree on.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Joel, thank you very much for the call. Be sure to check out movetoamend.org, by the way. They're pulling together a coalition of Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, Greens, everybody on this one issue of ending this idea that money is speech and corporations are persons. Thank you, Joel. Dan in Great Lakes, and corporations, by the way, would include unions. Unions are incorporated, even though they're not for profit. Dan in Great Lakes, Illinois. Hey, Dan, got a minute. It's yours.
Hi, Tom. God bless you for the work that you do, Tom.
Thank you.
It's not until the citizenry is brought to its knees, in my opinion, that we will begin to see that they have bamboozled us. As long as there are Gucci bags, Coach bags, tablets, Androids, and automobiles that we can get on payments to pretend that we somehow have something in common with billionaires, it's not going to change. There's far many more of us than there is of them. But we've lost our way somehow, and they've used these things, stuff, as pacifiers to anesthetize us in the midst of having our limbs amputated.
I agree.
That's all.
I would add to that the media. I mean, we're being entertained to death, including in our news, which is no longer news. It's now infotainment. And I, you know, absolutely, Dan, thank you for the call. Well said. 15 minutes before the hour, we'll be back with more here on the Tom Hartman Program. FDR. In essence, it is fascism, ownership of government by any individual, by a group, or by any other controlling power, private power.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Have we become fascist by the definitions of Henry Wallace and his president, Franklin Roosevelt? And if so, how do we undo it? Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Mary in Bourne, Texas, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to ask you, this Sunday, I heard an interview with Governor of Ohio.
Right, John Kasich?
Yeah. I think they're getting him ready for president.
Of course they are.
Well, he didn't speak like the rest of the, you wouldn't think he was a Republican. And I wondered if you knew anything about his background, because he sounded so Democratic.
Yeah. He's been involved in the dark side of Republican politics for a long, long time. John Kasich, along with Paul Weyrich, the guy who famously said, "I don't want everybody to vote. Our leverage in the election, frankly, goes up as the voting populace goes down." Those two guys were among the principal co-founders some 30 years ago or more of the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. John Kasich has been involved in the most toxic realm of Republican politics, as far as I can tell, for his whole entire life. I don't have his bio in front of me beyond that, but Jane Carter of Ask Me has pointed that out a number of times to me, that Kasich and Weyrich were the guys. So, yeah, and it makes a lot of sense that John Kasich would be running for president, and well, Scott Walker, too.
What scares me on that is that I just heard recently about how close Hillary is to Wall Street, and I'm just worried about who's going to be running against, probably her.
Against Hillary Clinton?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I mean, I think it's too early to judge. Now, I realize that, you know, others think I'm totally wrong on this, and leopards don't change their spots or whatever the phrase is. But I think that Hillary Clinton is a smart enough politician. When you hear Chuck Schumer giving a speech, as he did a week ago today here in Washington, D.C., about the value of populism, about how Bill Clinton governing in the frame of the Reagan Revolution was not a good thing, how Obama should have been doing more, and you know, I think to some extent Schumer was criticizing himself. You know, the Democrats in Congress should have been doing more during the early era of the Obama presidency when he had Congress for 72 legislative days, should have been doing more for average working people, that they shouldn't have been bailing out the banksters. Now, he failed to point out that the bailing out of the banksters started, and most of those decisions were made in a way that would be really, really hard to reverse, during the Bush administration by Henry Paulson, who was a former CEO of Goldman Sachs. But still, when you hear Chuck Schumer talking like that, I think it's entirely possible that Hillary Clinton will start talking like that. We'll see.
I heard Hutchins, everybody was saying, what can we do about it? Hutchins said that we have to be willing to protest and be ready to go to jail and keep it up.
Yeah, you're talking about Chris Hitchens?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Chris Hitchens is a good voice for those of us who essentially stand on the outside, and he's a very, very good voice for Americans. And, you know, my problem with Chris is he's just a little too intensely cynical at times. But he's been a war correspondent. That's a really, really difficult thing. He's seen the worst of humans. Mary, thank you for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service coming up next. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service. TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old Goat.com. And free-don.org. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today?
I see you're at the White House. I am at the White House in the basement.
Uh-huh.
And the White House briefing is going on even as we speak. I just ducked out. Josh Earnest, the White House spokesman, has been asked about the CIA torture report from the Senate Intelligence Committee, which will, we understand, come out tomorrow, Tuesday.
Wow, how heavily redacted is it going to be?
Well, the understanding is that the redactions originally were 15%, which sent Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Dianne Feinstein, Democrat of California, completely over the edge, because a lot of the redactions were of the names of CIA officers, so she said it made it completely non-understandable and pointless. So she's been fighting with the White House and the CIA since the summer over this. They've now got the redactions down to 5%, a lot of them are still names and pseudonyms, but she says this is as good as it's going to get. That's 5% redactions at this point, and it will be a 480-page summary of a 6,300-page still classified report. And she wants this out now, and one of the reasons she feels it has to come out now is that the 113th Congress is likely to come to a close by Thursday or Friday, and at that point she will give up the gavel of the chairmanship because the Senate will no longer be controlled by Democrats.
Right. So.
And the Republicans are likely to put it in a bottom drawer and lose the key.
Right. So this, yeah, of course. So this is her last hurrah here.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
What about one of the? I think was it Tom Harkin was saying, you know, I'm leaving this place, and if somebody else doesn't publicize this thing, I'll read it into the record.
I believe it was Udall.
Oh, Udall, that's right.
Yeah, Udall was saying that he would read it into the record, and he's been taken very seriously on that.
Yeah, which is another bit of pressure that helps Dianne Feinstein do it in a slightly more controlled fashion.
Exactly. Now, Josh Earnest was asked about the report today. The White House spokesman, he said that the administration has for months been preparing for this release. He says there are some indications that the release of the report could lead some individuals and some facilities, American around the world, to be in danger. So they have been beefing them up. They've taken steps, he said. But the administration does strongly support the release. So then he was asked, why then did Secretary of State John Kerry, after talking with President Obama last week, call Senator Dianne Feinstein to try to say to her, please delay the release of the report? What was that all about? So Earnest this afternoon says, well, Kerry strongly and clearly supports the release of the report, and Obama and Kerry share that view. And so he was pressed on this. Well, if he strongly supports the release of the report, why did he push Feinstein to delay the release of the report? And all we could get out of Earnest was, well, we refer you to Kerry for that.
Yeah. I think this is an example of, you know, the reason why these prosecuting attorneys in Ferguson and in New York and in Long Island don't want to prosecute cops is because the cops essentially work for them. And they don't want to dump on the people who are necessary to hold them up. The Secretary of State, you know, the State Department, the CIA doesn't directly work for John Kerry, but he's part of that machine that includes the CIA, and they're about to be very badly embarrassed. And he's got to be getting incredible pressure from the bottom up not to do this.
And the CIA and former Bush administration officials will be, and the Republicans on the Senate Intelligence Committee will all be producing rebuttals to this report.
Of course, of course.
We should expect that. Now, we had royalty in the White House this morning.
Yes, I saw the pictures on CNN of Prince William and sitting with President Obama.
Yes, Prince William was here. It was great fun. I was teasing everybody that the British had come back. And yeah, and people were saying, we fought a war. I said, it doesn't matter. It's 1812 all over again, mates. And they didn't know really what to do about it.
Well, he didn't bring a torch with him, so
no,
the White House
didn't, and I didn't either, so it's all right, and of course I'm an American citizen. Prince William, of course, is in Washington, D.C. to speak to the World Bank about the illegal wildlife trade, which is a passion of his brother Prince Harry's, and also of Kate Middleton, William's wife. And he put an op-ed in the Huffington Post today saying that he would be highlighting the link between corruption, wild and natural resource crime, and illicit trade, also pointing out how major this crime is. He says that it is the fourth largest crime at this point. He said the trade in animal parts like elephant tusk and rhino horn is now worth $10 to $20 billion. It also is responsible. 1,200 park rangers have been killed in the past few years. So it's not just animals that are being slaughtered, it's human beings as well. And they also think that there's increasing evidence that terrorist groups are using the illegal wildlife trade to fund their activities.
Yeah, particularly in Central Africa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So very serious business. Yeah. The New York Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman, today has asked the governor of New York to empower him to investigate all deaths of unarmed civilians at the hands of police in the state.
Whoa!
Yeah.
That's incredible. Why hasn't the Attorney General of Missouri done something like that?
Maybe the person will get that idea now.
Yeah, could be. Although I think he's a Republican.
That the public has little confidence in local prosecutors' ability to investigate police officers with whom they work closely. So he's calling on Governor Andrew Cuomo to authorize state-led investigations and prosecutions of police. The move is necessary to address a crisis of confidence, he says.
Now, this does not require legislation. This is simply a policy call by the governor, right?
That's correct.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm astonished that he has to ask for Cuomo to do that, frankly. Yeah. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Always great to see you, Victoria. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And keep up the great work. We'll be back. We're going to be talking about with Shane Davis about fracking, and then back to your calls.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And pleased to have you with us. Shane Davis is on the line with us, a fractivist. In fact, he's been dubbed by Outside Magazine the Nate Silver of fracking. Fractivist, fractivist.org is his website. Hey, Shane.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing today?
Just fine. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And by the way, on Free Speech TV, there tonight at 9:30 p.m., there's going to be a special showing of the film Groundswell Rising, Protecting Our Children's Air and Water, which features you. And you can check your local listings or go to freespeech.org for more details about this. Tell me what are you doing and how are you doing it?
Sure. I'm actually data mining the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission's website. I've been doing that for about 5.5 years. And so these are all front door access doorways to gain information that the oil and gas industry has to abide by.
Right.
So the state of Colorado has this online system, and all of these forms that the oil and gas industry, or as we should call it, the fracking industry, has to use these forms, and all of this data gets stored in a central database, and there are millions and millions of documents. And so I acquire those documents. I find special events and vulnerabilities such as spills, violations. Even our own aquifer in Colorado was contaminated in 2009 by a well casing failure. And so I do some extreme thorough investigations on actual official state documents that are irrefutable, and I provide these documents to communities all over Colorado so that they can use that information in their backyards to call for moratoria or bans. But it's really just exposing the sheer epic violations of the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission and the industry, and how that information completely gets suppressed and never sees the light of day. So I expose that on my blog.
The Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, is this a state agency, a federal agency?
Yeah, this is a state agency. As we know, the oil and gas industry has been exempted by numerous federal protective laws, in which case now states have preemption over oil and gas operations. So the COGCC, or the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation, has preemption over oil and gas or the fracking industry here in Colorado.
And they and presumably they're supposed to behave in the interests of Coloradans, of the citizens of the state. That being the case, why are they not doing their job? Why are they not publicizing the things that you're publicizing?
Well, certainly, I think it would showcase their epic failures. I did a spill study groundwater contamination. So I analyzed 1,000 official spill reports that are stamped official and approved by the state of Colorado. And after 1,000 spill reviews, 40% of those have already resulted in groundwater contamination. I mean, these are epic failures of the state to conduct operations in a manner consistent with public health, safety, and welfare for the Colorado citizens and the environment.
Well, the state's not conducting these operations. It's private drillers, isn't it?
True, but the private drillers are actually mandated by the preemption of the state of Colorado. And so they must abide by these regulations that are in a manner consistent with public health, safety, and welfare also.
Which they're failing to do.
Epically failing.
And the regulatory agency is not regulating them.
The regulatory agency is absolutely failing the citizens of Colorado and the environment.
Why?
Special interests. Obviously, the vast majority of the COGCC has oil and gas interests. In fact, the new director, Matt Lepore, he's the director of the COGCC now. His previous job was working on behalf of a law firm that fights for the fracking industry to fight for, you know, land usage, mineral usage, and oil and gas extraction.
Wow.
So the state is stacked with oil and gas interests, and it's completely in conflict of interest, and they have obviously no impartiality, and it's completely fascist as well.
Here's a quote from Franklin Roosevelt. He said, "The first truth is that the liberty of a democracy is not safe if the people tolerate the growth of private power to a point where it becomes stronger than their democratic state itself. That, in essence, is fascism, ownership of our government by an individual, by a group, or by any other controlling private power." We have here ownership of a state agency by the industry that is supposed to regulate it. Is that your assertion?
Absolutely. I mean, you've got such a conflict of interest that the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission cannot abide by its own mission statement to protect the people and the environment in a way that is consistent with public health, safety, and welfare, which ironically is still their mission statement.
Right.
And so I've debated dozens of oil and gas executives, three different directors of the state, and I only use their own information to show them their failures. And in fact, they can't beat it because it's their own data. If they say their own data is wrong, we're still right. But somehow we have to actually amplify the epic failures of the state. I mean, 94% of all fracking operator permits are approved. Obviously, there's some arbitrary decision-making going on. It's a rubber stamp. But all of the failures, like our own aquifer was contaminated with fracking gas, toluene, which is an EPA-known frack fluid, from a well casing failure, thousands and thousands of spills that have already contaminated groundwater are on the state's website, air violations, and the list goes on and on. It's just a matter of surfacing these epic failures, as I call them, so that the public knows. And the state should be held accountable for it.
Right. So this documentary about that you are featured in tonight on Free Speech TV at 9:30, Groundswell Rising, Protecting Our Children's Air and Water. Tell me about it.
Groundswell Rising, it's a great name because what you're seeing across the United States and globally is this heavily active resistance against the fracking industry and all of the government agencies and elected officials that are allowing this type of civil rights violation to happen. Mm. It's really not an anti-fracking movement anymore. It's a civil rights movement. Groundswell Rising shows sort of cross-platform various types of inflictions that the industry is doing by harming citizens, you know, that are just trying to live their normal lives. So Groundswell Rising is that. It's this growing of activists and advocates across America standing up for their civil rights to say no to this oligarchy.
Wow. So where do we, I mean, are you getting any traction? I mean, other than you know, angering the oil industry executives and presumably the people who work for this regulatory agency in Colorado, is anything happening as a consequence of your exposure of these things?
Yeah, I mean, for about 5.5 years, we've been doing this. We've got, you know, a number of moratoria and bans that are in place. We've got you know, over 300,000 activists who signed our ballot initiatives to stop fracking in Colorado. The industry has spent tens of millions of dollars against our pennies, and we beat them every time. Even though our communities are being sued, that doesn't, it's not going to stop us. One of the things I like to talk about is, you know, the fractivists worldwide, the energy of all the fractivists will outlast all the energy the industry could ever extract. We're not going anywhere, ever. And so our personal sacrifice will beat their money every time. And so with this information, people are becoming aware that there are so many failures that are not being told to us. And it's upon us, the people sitting at home, to do this kind of due diligence, find this information, send it out there, run it up the flagpole, and show that these people are failing, and in fact, possibly file class action lawsuits against them and shut them down.
There you go. Shane Davis, great. You're doing God's work, my friend. Fractivist.org is the website, and the movie tonight is Groundswell Rising, Protecting Our Children's Air and Water, 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Free Speech TV, freespeech.org. Thank you, Shane.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more of the news of the day, my thoughts on it, your thoughts on my thoughts, and on the news of the day right after this. And your thoughts on Jim's thoughts on what the... Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 15 minutes past the hour. And... boy, we've only got one Free Speech TV caller. We got radio stations all over the country. That's remarkable. Be sure, yeah. Oh, you got the number on the screen too, huh? Edmund in Hot Springs National Park. Do I have that right, Edmund? Watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network.
That is correct.
Hey, Edmund, what's on your mind
today?
That
is correct. Thanks for taking my call. I know that you lived in Germany and worked there, and I had a question for you. Albrecht brothers in Germany, they are as wealthy as our Koch brothers, around $45 billion worth of wealth, and they owe all the supermarkets in Europe. And I was wondering if German public would tolerate that Albrecht brothers influence their democracy the same way that Koch brothers have done in the United States.
I would be
and
very
if
surprised.
Not, why not?
I would be very surprised if the Germans would tolerate that. They have very strong anti-corruption laws. The ability to buy politicians the way that activists, both right and left, have here in the United States is radically diminished. They don't have a, quote, First Amendment in their Constitution. The so-called right to free speech doesn't exist. So, I don't think it's going to happen. Don't think it's going to happen. Edmund, thank you for the call. And we need to learn more about that. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Well, I found Shane's report pretty interesting. I just think it's interesting too that fracking, which requires, you know, like 80,000 gallons of well in a state like Colorado, which is mostly semi-arid, I think anywhere from 8 to 10 inches of rain is what they get a year. And so any, use of water, you know, that extreme use of water, I would think really would compete so much with, cities, municipalities, farmers, and then also the damage, you know, if there is any spills or anything to the water supply would, you know, really be difficult for people to have to deal with. And also I wanted to, you know, it's too bad, you know, it wasn't like you could ask him a question if he was on for the whole segment, but I wanted to ask, how about all the state and public lands, the public lands, which are often federal lands in Colorado, what jurisdiction does the state have over regulating fracking wells there?
Oh, that's a good question. I think the preemption that he was talking about would give the state authority over federal land that's also state land, that's within the state. But
right.
I can't definitively answer that. It would be a good question. It's a shame he's gone. I'll have to look into that.
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for the call, John. I appreciate it. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. which, by the way, Free Speech TV right now is in their pledge drive, their fund drive. Please give them a call at 877-378-8669 and add your voice, add a little cash. Not that they're the same, to Free Speech TV. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past. The hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Chris in Darlington, South Carolina. Hey, Chris, 30 years of driving up and down the highways?
Yep. 30 years driving a truck. One thing about last week's conversation about, you know, racial profiling and whether or not it exists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, as you pointed out several times, the statistics say that whites use drugs at the same rate as blacks. And for 30 years, I've seen cops doing random searches on the side of the road where they take people's cars apart, you know, empty suitcases into the grass, and you just strew people's belongings all over the place searching for drugs. And that, I've never seen a white family searched. I've seen blacks, Hispanics, even a few Orientals, but never, you know, never seen a white family get their belongings just thrown on the ground and, you know, their car taken apart and searched on the side of the road like they do with blacks.
Yep. Welcome to the wonderful world of white privilege. And most white people probably don't even recognize that or understand that. Chris, thanks for sharing your experience with us and adding to the conversation. Nancy in Plano, Texas. Hey, Nancy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm really glad that my call today. I really appreciate all the work that you do. And I called because of the article regarding the attorneys general and the oil companies.
Mm-hmm.
Being in Texas, it's not the least bit surprising that Greg Abbott, our former attorney general and soon to be governor, is on the top of the list. Of course, being a blue person in a red state, this makes my head explode. But it's convenient that there is a series of articles that started in our local paper, the Dallas Morning News, titled How FDR's Island Visit Helped Birth an Era of Texas Power. And it was how he went down there in May of 1937 and visited Sid Richardson and Clint Murchison Sr. And at that point, John Nance Gardner was his vice president.
Right.
And apparently Cactus Jack was quite the proponent of oil at that time. And it talks about, that article talks about how that started the oil power with the federal government and how it helped LBJ get elected. And in my opinion, it made it kind of sound like, oh, well, the Republicans are doing it now, but look, the Democrats did it before. Everybody's doing it.
Yeah, well, that may well be, actually. But the mm-hmm. fact of the matter is that 10, 15 years ago, when we talked about the dangers of oil, we mm-hmm. were principally talking about asthma and cancers from oil being
right.
burned badly. And that, you know, and so you've come up with things like catalytic converters and you know, cap and trade for sulfur dioxide. And what you end up with is relatively clean air. And you get a lot of the poison right. out of the air, and it seems like problem solved. But now we realize that, you know, the bigger consequence of burning all this oil is that we're warming up the planet and putting all life on Earth at risk. And that has brought us to a fairly partisan divide where mostly the Republicans are saying, that's okay, we don't care about the planet because we don't believe these scientists, and or we would rather believe our donors than these scientists. And the Democrats are saying, you know, hey, we know how to read science, you know, it's like.
Exactly. And my father-in-law was an oil man, and I know that none of these oil companies want any regulations whatsoever.
Sure.
And they're, you know, in Texas, they just buy the politicians.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's not just in Texas. Now, the Supreme Court has made this legal. It's been legal for 30 years, 40 years. And the consequence of that is that we have the best money, the democracy money can buy, and that's a tragedy. Nancy, thanks for calling and sharing that story. It's fascinating. Lynn in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Lynn, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I've
calling to tell you about, I smoke out corporate moles in 2012 before the election.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to copy and paste. I did this on Facebook, so I used to copy and paste definitions of fascism or fascist from the Microsoft Word. Anyway, they changed the definition of fascism or fascist to names that liberals call Republicans.
Really?
Yes.
The Microsoft Dictionary?
Pardon?
The Microsoft Dictionary, if you look up fascism,
exactly.
It says a name that liberals call Republicans?
Exactly. And then they changed it from that to something that doesn't even make sense. It's just like the definition of the history of it. That's what the definition is replaced with.
Right. So, that's bizarre. That's like, you know, it's like the perversion of Wikipedia. Wikipedia is a great idea and a great organization and all that kind of thing. But there are very well-funded think tanks in this town and all over the country where they hire people at a fairly, you know, kind of an entry-level wage to just sit in rooms and edit Wikipedia, or do it at home for that matter, and edit Wikipedia constantly in very subtle ways that just slightly tilt the table, you know, just slightly tilt the conversation, whether it's with regard to free trade or whether it's with regard to the effect of Smoot-Hawley or whether it's with regard to the consequences of the FDR presidency or the Reagan presidency for that matter. And it's like this bias that has crept into our language, into our dictionary. Now, you know, Wikipedia has become basically our default dictionary, and there is no oversight of it other than within it. You know, it's a great idea. You know, the small d democracy is a great idea. But when the predators come out and they've got resources that can overwhelm the democratic gatekeepers, it's an idea that is at risk. And I think that that's a shame. Wikipedia is doing a fundraising drive, and it's a great time to support them and to say, you know, tighten things up a little bit here. But it's not just Wikipedia, Microsoft, apparently.
I know.
Yeah, this definition of fascism is, and I haven't looked up fascism on Wikipedia to see how they're defining it these days, but amazing. But Lynn, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. By the way, Harvey K just tweeted, "Hey, Tom, don't forget to mention my book on FDR." Okay, Harvey, you've got it. Harvey K wrote a book on FDR. I think it's called The Four Freedoms. Yeah, The Four Freedoms. And it's a great book. We've had Harvey on the program about it. My favorite book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, right? My favorite Harvey K book is Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. It's incredible. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And we'll be back with your calls and my thoughts and the news of the day and all that kind of stuff, right? Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman, actually 4 hours a day, 5 days a week. So we do a TV show in the evening also. On Free Speech TV and RT TV. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Kurt in Los Angeles, we've kind of wandered into this topic of fascism in the United States. I started out with just, you know, we no longer have a functioning republic. What do we have? And it seems like there's a growing consensus that it's essentially fascist. Kurt, what's on your mind?
Yeah, Tom, thanks for taking my call. Well, I have so much I want to talk about, it's hard to land it. But let me start with this. Are you familiar with these stores that some were open and some were closed on Thanksgiving?
Yeah, the whole controversy about whether or not stores should force their employees to show up for Thanksgiving under threat of losing their jobs.
Right. Yeah. Now, I had a theory, and I went and did some checking, and my theory didn't hold up 100%.
Mm-hmm.
But I did do a comparison between those that were open and those that were closed, and it does turn out that of the stores that were closed, only one of the major chains is part of ALEC. However, of the stores that were open, there's at least four or five major chain stores that are part of ALEC.
Hmm.
And I bring that up because for those who don't really know about ALEC, ALEC is this consortium, legal consortium that draws up bills that congressmen are supposed to do, but they don't because they spend most of their time trying to raise money. But instead, ALEC force spoon feeds these bills that do nothing but attack individual civil liberties of most individuals, and they use bribery and all kind of tricks to get these congressmen to then push this bill into law.
I wouldn't say it's bribery. They grease the skids for them, though, by all means. It's legally not bribery. I think morally it is, but yeah.
Well, because of Citizens United, it's not, right. It's not bribery because of Citizens United. They're making it legal for them to push money, you know, into campaigns and have it be legal. But see, that's part of the whole mess. And so, so what I'm saying is that, there's a three-layer nefarious thing going on here, because you have to ask yourself, where do most of these corporations or these big monolithic retail stores get their money from?
They get it from you and me.
Right. They get it from people.
Right.
So they put on these commercials with these smiling faces. Hey, come shop with us. You know, we're here for you. Da-da-da-da-da. They take your money smiling in your face in the front door, but then they grease the skids and they bribe congressmen out the back door that do nothing but try to push legislation to not pay their fair share of taxes, make taxes higher for the middle class and the poor, keep women from, you know, having their own right to decide about birth control. I mean, they do all kind of wicked stuff with their profits,
right.
You know, and I see this going on, and I try to ask people sometimes, you know, if you were renting a house and you discover that your landlord was dealing drugs, buying and selling drugs, even though he doesn't sell drugs directly to you and your kids, just the fact that your money is being used for nefarious activity, I would move. You know, I wouldn't continue to let, you know, pay money to a landlord that deals drugs on the side because it's just wrong.
Right.
You know, so since corporations want to be treated as people nowadays, they want to, you know, have their free speech considered money, whatever, then my attitude is I'm going to do business with people that I like, and I don't like people that'll spend their profits to hurt people rather than helping to buy textbooks for kids, you know, in certain school districts, you know, spend money, build a bridge somewhere. You know, it'd be great instead of a Staples event center. That's great. But, you know, I would like to see some company, whoever it is, go out to Michigan or Oregon or Seattle, wherever these bridges you hear about crumbling, and build a darn bridge, you know, and if they want to charge a toll to pay for the bridge, that's fine. But do something.
Right. Well, they would have to appropriate that land from the government. And there's a large move to make that happen. I mean, that's the whole libertarian agenda, which is privatize all our roads in the United States, turn them all into toll roads so that when people are out driving, they are increasing the profits of corporations that go into the toll road business. And there are several toll roads now in the United States that have been built by these corporations. The two largest are based out of Spain and Australia, and they own a toll road, a major one in downtown Atlanta, for example. There's one in this neighborhood. I'm not sure exactly where, but it's like this is not a good idea. This is, if there's anything that should be part of the commons, it's our transportation infrastructure, particularly our roads. And, you know, this is that failure to clearly understand the difference between the commons, between common space, public space, and private space. And, you know, I have no problem with businesses doing business in private space, but in public space, that should be we the people. It should be government. And
I agree. And maybe that's a bad example, but we need bridges, though, you know, and it's like if the Republicans
want to cut build
budgets to where we can't build a bridge. We can't keep the, you know, bridges up.
Well, it's been that way since 1980. I mean, when Reagan came into office, they basically stopped all public works spending. If you look at your schools these days, you know, half of them were built prior to 1980. Most of them were built in the 50s and 60s. And, you know, when we were building infrastructure, most of our roads were built then. Most of our bridges and tunnels were built then. We just don't build things anymore, and we haven't done it since Reaganomics, because Reagan cut that top tax rate on rich people from 74% down to 28%, and we didn't have the money. You know, all these Republican politicians, they love to run around going, hey, the government's broke. We don't have any money. Look at the deficit, blah, blah, blah. Well, this is the brilliance of Reaganomics, is you cut off the supply of money by not taxing rich people. They will, you know, move that money into the Cayman Islands, and they'll figure out a way to make a fortune with it. But it screws the average American. It screws our infrastructure. It destroys the country over time. Kurt, I got to move along, but thanks for your call. Well said. Rodney in Chicago. Hey, Rodney, what's up?
Tom, hey, I got a robocall from the president of the Laborers International Unit of North America, Terry O'Sullivan, and he said that there's a bill before the House to require pension plans to carry more insurance, and if it goes through over the first 5 years, it will cost the pension fund $100 million that would otherwise go to retirees.
Wow.
So he said, encourage us to call our representatives, which I did. I called my representative and my two senators, but perhaps you could get Terry O'Sullivan or Richard Trumka, head of the AFL-CIO, on to explain exactly what they're up to. But it sounds like another way to rob the working people.
Yeah. Is O'Sullivan all one word, O apostrophe Sullivan, or is it O period?
Yes, sir. Yeah, O apostrophe Sullivan.
Okay, Terry O'Sullivan.
And they have offices in D.C., so I'm sure that's where he's at. And
yeah.
Richard Trump.
What's the union?
CIO. That's the Laborers International Union of North America.
Laborers International. Okay.
Yeah, but I want to encourage everybody, all your listeners, to call their representatives and tell them that to vote no on this requirement for pension funds to carry additional insurance.
Yeah, it sounds like another way of trying to, you know, kneecap the unions. But until I learn more about it.
Either Terry O'Sullivan or Richard Trump on to explain.
Yeah, exactly, we're on it. I'm on it. Rodney, thank you for the call. Bill in St. Helens, Oregon. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I've had two thoughts for a long time now. Number one, corporations are either directly or indirectly owned by people. So the minute we give corporations personhood, what we're really doing is giving a select group of people extra special rights, just a little more rights than the rest of us. I would consider that unequal protection under the law. And on this whole issue of money is speech, kind of the same argument, different vein, it goes without saying that when those with more money can speak louder. I mean, you and I, you know, I'm sure we have considerably more money than I have. You and I can stand on the street corner and scream as loud as we want. Perhaps I can scream louder than you, but not enough to make a difference. But the minute we say that money is a form of free speech, what we're really saying is that people with more money can speak more loudly, be heard by more people, and more grossly influence our elections and our form of government. So, once again, they're getting that from the First Amendment, which is the law of the land. And I would argue with anybody, and like to see them, you know, bust that argument, that saying that money is a form of speech is, in fact, institutionalized unequal treatment under the law, being the Constitution. Okay, that's my rant.
I agree. And, Bill, let me add to this. Here's a metaphor that I think will make it very, very clear to people. Because what they're saying is that if you or I were to stand on the street and protest or demonstrate or say something, that's politically protected speech. Similarly, if you and I were billionaires and we bought $100 million worth of advertisements, to promote a candidate or an idea, that's protected speech. But really, that's amplified speech when you're speaking through television or radio. And here's the metaphor. If you or I show up in front of the Department of whatever, you know, the Department of Commerce, say, to protest the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and, you know, we're just saying we're here, we're protesting, that's legal. But if we brought in a sound truck, not just a bullhorn, but a sound truck, you know, a giant speakers like at a rock event, you know, speakers loud enough to rattle the windows of the building and started yelling, no more TPP, no more TPP. That's no longer free speech. That's amplified free speech to the point that it has violated the rights of the people in the neighborhood and in the building to have some, you know, calm and peace and whatever. That is a behavior that can be legislatively or you know, by police action, regulated. And money in the political process should identically be regulated. Bill, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And if you want to know how to do this, go to MoveToAmend.org and check it out. We'll be back. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And Bob in Marietta, Georgia. Hey, Bob, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. What's up?
I was calling about the fracking you talked about earlier.
Yeah.
Hi, John. I was real happy to hear that you're coming back on Big Picture in January. That was good news.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear it, too. It's one of those little misunderstandings.
About fracking, what it seems to me the best way to stop fracking is to make the OPEC nations realize that oil is not going to be in big demand 30 years from now, so they should be trying to empty their wells and keep the price low so they can empty their wells, and fracking and the XL pipeline and all those things won't be profitable.
Right. Well, there is one.
Make them realize that oil won't be saleable 30 or 40 years from now. It's not going to be worth much because there won't be the demand there is today.
Yeah. Louise and I had a long conversation with Michael McDonald last night about this. Michael has been on the TV show as a great mind, and a conversations, a great mind segment. And he works with an organization that sets up resilience zones and resilient cities. They're working with in Sierra Leone, Guinea, and I forget the other country that has the Ebola problem in Western Africa right now. And I said, what's going on with this price of oil? Because I've been asking everybody this question. You know, is the United States driving this to punish Russia, Iran, Venezuela? Which is what's happening? Or is it that the Saudis are driving this to try to put American fracking companies out of business and stop fracking? Or is Saudi Arabia doing this to stop the momentum that wind and solar have now? Or is it all of the above? Or what? You know, who's doing this and why? And I haven't been able to find anybody who has a good, clear picture of it, other than that the Saudis are definitely driving this process. Whether they're doing it with the permission of the United States or not is another question. I mean, they've messed with the price of oil against our wishes in the past. Back in the 70s, you know, with the Arab oil boycott, the embargo, they jacked up the price of oil and threw the country into recession and produced inflation here. So, go ahead.
The key is that in the future, oil consumption is going to go down. It has to. So they should realize we have to sell our oil now while it's in demand, so let's keep the price low. And it will put the others out of business, which would be fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I think what they found is that as the price goes up, there is a certain point where, you know, at $100 barrel oil, 80% of America could convert to solar or wind at or below the cost of generating electricity or heating with oil. Whereas at $60 barrel oil, that 80% of America that could become energy, independent, without carbon, you know, drops substantially. I don't know what it drops to, but my, you know, wild ass guess would be somewhere in the neighborhood of half, you know, 50% of the country. And so, you know, by lowering the price of oil, I don't think that they're trying to sell it while they can by lowering the price. And they're flooding world markets to lower the price. I don't think it's a matter of trying to get it out of the ground and get it into people's hands. I think that what they're doing is trying to destroy their competition. And the nice fallout from the Obama administration's point of view is, A, it's a stimulus to our economy. Working people get a couple hundred bucks a year off their gas prices. So that's money they can spend on other things. And B, it hurts Russia, Iran, and Venezuela in particular, although it's also hurting Norway and the UK and us to a certain extent. But we'll see. See how this plays out, Bob. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be right back. It's Talk Media for the Sane Among Us, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Mark in Chicago. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I was calling about the issue of officer-involved fatalities and the push for transparency and changing the system. And I think you know, but your viewers might be interested to know that this past April, Wisconsin became the first state in the union to pass a law mandating just that, mandating external investigations for all police-involved deaths.
Yeah, and you know why?
Yeah, well, I actually worked on it with the team there, and the man behind it, a guy named Michael Bell, lost his son.
Right, and it was a white kid, right? So, you know, white kid gets killed by the police, the state changes their laws.
Well, it actually took him 10 years.
I know, I know. And he sued the state, and he got over $1 million, and he threw that into the campaign. And it's a real, you know, wonderful example of a guy who's just committed himself to doing something, you know, making a positive legacy for his dead son. And and I think the law is a great model law, and it should be in every state in the country. But
yeah, actually, New Jersey and New York in the past couple weeks have contacted the Wisconsin team with an eye towards emulating what we accomplished there.
That's great.
But one thing that that really helped Michael Bell and his team in Wisconsin was that we changed the law through sheer logic and facts,
mm-hmm.
and just sticking to the facts and underscoring that self-investigation just doesn't make sense at any level.
Right.
And the other thing is that we always stressed that it was pro-community, but it was also pro-police. We had a number of cops, ex-cops, no current cops, but a lot of ex-cops and ex-police chiefs who were on our team, and they were saying no good cop wants to be forced to feel the pressure of that blue wall of silence and investigate officers within his or her own department. It's not fair to the officers because they don't want that pressure, and it's best to kick it to an outside agency.
Right. Also, good cops don't want to be tarred with the same brush as bad cops. Tarred with. I wonder if that's a racist. Never, you know, every now and then you. What's the origin of that cliche? Anyhow, they don't want to be portrayed as being associated with bad cops.
Right, right. But all the cops on our team were ex-cops because they said when I was on the force, I couldn't come out and say the things I'm saying now because of that internal pressure, that systemic, that institutional pressure that a lot of cops feel, even the good ones.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But Mr. Bell pointing out that a lot of cops, you know, like you're saying, a lot of the good cops don't want to be painted with that brush, helped us get currency with several of the police unions and the sheriff's agencies in the state, and several of them actually signed off on the bill last spring.
That's great.
So we're hoping that other states and other listeners can look to, it's called Act 348 in Wisconsin, look to what happened in Wisconsin and contact their legislators and try and accomplish some of the same things.
Amen. Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for listening to WCPT. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking me. You had the guy on earlier talking about fracking.
Right.
Most people do not know that there's fracking going on here in Alabama also. This is being done in the Tallulah Bankhead National Forest. They're now seeking or have received permission to frack in the William Bankhead and the section that runs from Sylacauga on the east side up towards the north part where Rome, Georgia is. This fracking has now caused an earthquake here in Alabama. We had a 3.8 on November the 20th. Montgomery, our capital, is downstream of 10 locks and dams, four of which are now 85 years old. If they continue to frack and we continue to have earthquakes, at what point will this state become unlivable?
Wow.
This fracking has polluted the water in Marion. They now have iridium-124 in their water system. This is the home of the Marion Military Institute, guys out there, if you're listening. And, of course, this is north of Selma. And next year we have a reenactment, the 50th Civil Rights reenactment. Mm-hmm. Will people have any water to drink? And if they keep fracking and we keep having earthquakes, will the town even be here?
Wow.
Our water treatment plant comes from the Tallapoosa, which comes out of Georgia. The Coosa is so polluted now from benzene out of Rome where the Coke's paper mill is, and from Monsanto's carpet factory in the 60s, which killed people, that nobody can drink water out of the Coosa. But as this stuff washes down through Mobile and it winds up on Florida's coast, is anybody listening? Anybody care? And if we continue to have earthquakes in the center part of the country, you can pull up folkworm.cer and look at the earthquakes and pull up a map with the nuclear reactors and pull up a map with the fault lines, and you'll wonder, is there anybody in this country that's actually sane that's allowing this?
Yeah. Because, well, there's big money to be made, Norma, and so
yeah,
a little bit of insanity in the service of big money is the American way.
FEMA and the Red Cross, the National Guard, all the military and the police departments, law enforcement, had meetings 5 years ago, six of them, discussing what we would do if they wake up the New Madrid fault line. Right. You can pull up a map of these things if you've got enough computers and put them together like a jigsaw puzzle, and you'll wonder, are they actually trying to destroy the country? But when you lose a dam, Montgomery's on a floodplain. We'll lose the Capitol. Our fire department headquarters is also downtown on the floodplain, along with our police department and city council stuff. What kind of a mess would we have while they continue to frack here and destroy the water sources at the same time?
Right. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. Norma, thanks for the call, and thanks for sharing that with us. Amazing. Alabama, the fracking. We had an earthquake here in Washington, D.C. a couple of years ago, and I believe, I might be wrong, but I believe that there was some fracking activity going on within 100 miles of us, and that they tamped it down, although they're talking about fracking in Maryland now that they got a Republican governor. So it's bizarre. Anyhow, thanks so much for being with us today. And be sure to share the Henry Wallace and FDR quotes far and wide. They're really good. And you can easily find them just by Googling their names and my name, or DuckDuckGoing it. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require us to all participate. And that's more than just vote. Show up. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.